This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dick Waterman, is the only non-performer in the Blues Hall of Fame. Many great concerts and recordings would never have happened without him. In the mid-60s, after falling in love with the blues, he founded Avalon Productions, the first agency devoted exclusively to managing and promoting blues musicians. Some of the musicians who have been on his roster include Son House, Skip James, Mississippi John Hurt, Booker White, Buddy Guy, Junior Wells, and Bonnie Raitt. Waterman usually had his camera with him at concerts and ended up creating a huge archive of blues photos. Only in the past few years have they been exhibited. Now many of these photos are collected in the new book Between Midnight and Day, the last unpublished blues archive. The book includes an introduction by Peter Guralnick and a preface by Bonnie Raitt. In the 60s, Waterman helped rediscover several important blues musicians who had vanished from public view, including Son House. Here's one of the recordings made by Son House in 1965, shortly after his rediscovery.
I went down to the station. I say I leaned up against the door. Yes, I went down to the station. And I never guessed the door. You know I'm not an impostate. Any time I hear a blow, well, I ask the people, let me ride. Let me ride it blind. Oh, devotion, please let me ride it blind. Mine is son, but this impostate ain't mine. You know, he's son an impostate.
Son House first recorded for Paramount Records in the 30s. Folklorist Alan Lomax recorded him in the early 40s for the Library of Congress, and that's the last his fans heard of him, until Dick Waterman and his friends Nick Pearls and Phil Spiro tracked Son House down. After searching for leads in Memphis and Mississippi, in 1964 they found Son House in Rochester, New York, a cold and snowy city in upstate New York. I asked Waterman what Son House was doing there.
Well, he had worked for the New York Central Railroad. He had moved up there probably about 1943, and he had lied about his age, making himself younger, to get a job on the New York Central, and he worked on the Empire State Express, which was the train, I think it ran from New York to Chicago, and he was a porter on the train, and then he retired. He wasn't working when we found him in 64.
How did you explain to him why you were there and why you had tracked him down?
Well, we brought along a tape recorder, a reel-to-reel, and we played him some of the music of his contemporaries. We played some Charlie Patton and then Robert Johnson, who was a protege, a younger musician, and we played some of his recordings from 1930 and 1941-42. And, of course, a person doesn't hear their own voice recognizable on a recording. So he would listen to it and nod and say, "Ah, that fellow's got some of my words." And I would say, "No, no, no, that's you, that's you." And his wife came into the room and she said, "Yeah, that's you, that's you." So he listened to it and he really wasn't fascinated. He wasn't all that, it just wasn't really meaningful to him. And we told him that there were people, that there were white people who were listening to him and Robert Johnson and Charlie Patton and to some of his proteges, that some of the people that he had mentored or influenced, like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf.
And you mentioned there was white people who were listening.
Yes, there were really very, very few people other than young white people who were young, literate, financially well off, going to Harvard or Yale or Wesleyan or Brandeis or MIT. That really was the audience. You have to understand that back in the 1960s, almost all acoustic music came under the folk umbrella, that Cajun and Zydeco and Bluegrass and Old Timey and Delta Blues, all of it was presented at folk festivals.
Did you try to convince some house to return to recording and performing?
Well, it didn't take any convincing because he was retired. He wasn't doing anything, and it was an opportunity to get out there and make some money. So, sure, he was okay with it. It was all very low-key that there was a festival in Philadelphia. So I drove up to Rochester, picked him up. We went down to the Philadelphia Folks Festival in 1964. That was actually his first comeback appearance where he played for the first time.
Did he remember his songs, and could he still sing and play?
He could still sing. Sondheim had one of the great, great, deep, rich delta voices of all time. He hadn't played guitar very much, so a friend of mine in Cambridge, a man named Al Wilson, who later moved to Los Angeles and was a founding member of the group Canned Heat. Al Wilson sat with Son, and they sat knee to knee with their guitars. And Al said, "This is how you played this song in 1930, and then he would play it, and Son would nod. And he said, "Then when Lomax came in the 40s, you had changed My Black Mama to My Black Woman, and this is how you played it." And Son nodded his head, and then they would play along. So really, Al Wilson taught Sondheim to play Sondheim, that there very clearly would never have been a second Sondheim career unless Al Wilson or someone very much like him brought Sondheim's recollection back.
God, that's so interesting, and it's such an interesting development that records, would enable somebody to be able to do that, that Al Wilson learned the Sondheim stuff through the records and then was able to subtly teach it back to Sondheim.
Really, that's true.
Yeah. So Well, once you started to work with Sondheim, you helped him get a recording contract. And I want to play one of the recordings that came out of that. This is one that you suggested that we play. It's called Grinnin' in Your Face. It was recorded in 1965. It's an a cappella recording. What do you think of his singing on this recording?
It's just, I think, very, very typical of the great Delta singers, that they sang very low and very throaty, and yet there's that flared falsetto where the voice soars up into the falsetto range. He was simply a great, great singer, and that's one of the reasons that I chose this. He was a great guitarist in the 1930s and 40s. His skills did diminish after he was rediscovered in the 1960s. His hands became slower, of course, but he always had this great voice, and so I have chosen this song because I think Grinning in Your Face shows what a great singer he was.
Okay, this is Sondheim, recorded in 1965.
Don't you mind people grinning in your face? Don't mind people grinning in your face. Yeah, just bear this in mind. A true friend is hard to find. Don't you mind people grinning in your face. You know your mother will talk about you. Your sisters and your brothers too. Yes, don't care how you're trying to live. They'll talk about you still. Yes, but bear who is in mind. A true friend is hard to find. Don't you mind people grinning in your face. Don't mind people grinning in your face. Don't mind.
That's Sondheim, recorded in 1965. My guest Dick Waterman helped rediscover Sondheim in 1964. It must have been so thrilling to watch some of the original blues musicians make their comeback in the 60s. You got to do that. You got to watch that with Skip James. Tell us a little bit about Skip James before we go any further with this story, his importance in the history of blues.
He recorded for Paramount in 1931 and then just flat out vanished. That he was rediscovered in 64, but in the interim 33 years, there's really no detailed record of where he went or if he played professional music or if he did any other recordings. That it was just an absolute total void that he made a few sides for Paramount. And he had this high, thin, wailing voice, very, very thin. And when he was found in 64, they found him in a hospital in Tunica, Mississippi, and then they brought him to Washington for a week or two, and then they brought him to Newport in 1964. So there was a great deal of expectancy that people sat and watched him because there were bluesmen, of course, had been on the scene all along, Josh White, Brownie and Sonny, and other bluesmen such as Booker White and Mississippi John Hurt had been rediscovered before Skip. So now here comes Skip at Newport 1964, and he was coming out of the void of 33 years, and people had absolutely no idea what he would be like or what skills he had retained over the years.
That performance that you're describing was actually documented on a live from the Newport Folk Festival recording that you've brought with you. So before we hear it, is there anything else you want to say about that recording?
Well, Skip James in 1964 only knew three or four songs, so he played the three or four songs at the afternoon workshop, and it was riveting. It was charismatic. It was just stunning. That's the word. It just stunned people. And the word swept the ground. Skip James, the Negro blues singer that has just come here, he's just astounding. So the night concerts, which were very tightly programmed, they shifted around and they found 11 or 12 minutes for him that night, and he did the same songs all over again. So he just was the one that people left the festival talking about. He was absolutely riveting.
Well, here's Skip James singing Devil Got My Woman as recorded at the Newport Folk Festival in 1964.
I rather be the devil. I rather be the devil. To be that woman, man. To be a man. To be a man.
In 1965, you became an agent for blues musicians. You formed your own production company, Avalon Productions. What did you want to represent blues musicians in addition to just like rediscovering them and enjoying their music?
Well, the blues artists were the last ones hired. They would hire somebody from North Carolina, Appalachian music, bluegrass, Cajun, Zydeco, then they'd get one of the New York Greenwich Village protest singers, or you know, Ian and Sylvia from Canada or someone like that, and then with whatever low money was left over, they would hire the blues singers, and the money being paid was just terribly, terribly low. The story that I tell in the book was that the great Robert Pete Williams, who lived in Louisiana, rode out to Los Angeles on the bus. And he played a weekend in a club for $100, sat around in someone's apartment doing nothing for 5 days, played the next weekend for another $100, and then got on the bus and drove back to Baton Rouge. And I thought that was just despicable, that I just couldn't have that happen. So I just had to step up and do something. So I rounded up four, five, six traditional blues artists. I named my company Avalon Productions for Mississippi John Hurt's hometown in Mississippi, Avalon. And I created a minimum price. And I said, I will speak for them, and this is their minimum price. I'll give you photographs, biographies, promotional material, travel itineraries. We're going to bring some degree of professionalism to this, but you're going to have to pay them much better. Then the artists themselves had to stand in loyalty to me, that they couldn't take work independently at home, that if someone called them at home for a job at low money, they had to say, no, I have an agent now, and it's Dick Waterman in Cambridge. So that really was where it started.
Some of the people you represented gave you a hard time, and one of them was Big Mama Thornton, who was known for, among other things, writing the song Ball and Chain that Janis Joplin later recorded. And you tell a really interesting story in your book about the time that Janis Joplin went to hear Big Mama Thornton. Would you tell us that story?
Well, it was a small jazz club in San Francisco, and I would say it was, I don't know, probably 1968, no, probably earlier than that, 67 or so. And I was in the club, and there were not many people in there. And Big Mama was appearing, and the door opened, and Janis and a guy came in, and there was a table right next to the stage, so they sat down. And Big Mama looked over, saw Janis, and boy, it was open season right there. And she started to say, said to Janis, and she said, now some people, they write songs, and they don't get nothing. And some people, what do those folk songs, they get themselves big houses, and they get to drive Porsche cars, and they get to sing about Mercedes Benz. But the people who write these songs, they don't get nair. And she went on and on, and Janis just sat there impassively, and Big Mama was just was doing tracks up and down. So after about 10 minutes, Janis looked at the guy she was with, nodded her head, reached into her purse, took out a $20 bill, put it on the table, got up and walked out.
Did you talk to Big Mama Thornton about that afterwards?
No, I didn't. She was really strong-minded. She was one of the most strong-minded people that I've ever met. And I worked with some people who had great focus and determination. But she was some piece of work. And the idea that I might not have gotten along with her doesn't put me on any short list.
I saw her perform in Buffalo once back in the late 60s probably, and she went into a tirade in the middle of the set where she just like talked for about 10 minutes straight about how people stole things from her and didn't credit her with them.
There's a story in the book of that performance in the Mance Lipscomb essay. He was playing before her in Buffalo, and she was sitting by the side of the stage drinking out of a bottle, just wanted to get on and get her show on and get off. And Mance happened to catch that magic night where you're really in sync with the audience. And he performed, and they're demanding an encore. So he was standing by the side of the stage, and Big Mama just glared at him. And Mance says, but Big Mama, they want me to go back on and do another one. So they're yelling, hollering. So Mance went on and did a song, his first encore. And then he came off, and the crowd was yelling and screaming for more. And Mance held his guitar and looked at Big Mama, and she looked at him, and she said, you threw. And he looked at 2,000 people yelling for an encore. He looked at Big Mama, and he nodded his head. He said, you right, Big Mama, I was through.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dick Waterman. Since 1964, he's rediscovered, managed, and promoted many blues musicians. He usually had his camera with him at concerts. His new book collects many of his photos. It's called Between Midnight and Day, The Last Unpublished Blues Archive. When was the point that made you decide to give up your career as a sports writer and instead devote yourself to blues and the musicians who played it?
There was a specific night. I was managing a Chicago blues man, and we were doing a show at Notre Dame University. And my artist came in late, and he had to use borrowed equipment, and he played very badly. So the gymnasium was divided in half, half of the audience and half, well, the other half was the backstage area. So the artist came off stage, and I followed him into the corner, and I was just livid. I said, you know, you didn't come ready to play, and when you go up there, my business name goes up there. Avalon Productions goes up there. I go up there. Junior Wells goes up there. Sunhouse goes up there. We all go up there. Your triumphs are our triumphs, and your embarrassments are our embarrassments. You didn't come ready to play. So he apologized and walked away. And the guy who was the director of student programming at Notre Dame said to me, boy, that was really dumb, man. You just... you embarrassed a blues musician in front of other blues musicians. I turned around and well, there was about 15 or 20 Chicago bluesmen sitting there staring at me. So I said, well, I really screwed up. So as I was walking, someone motioned me over to the table. And I looked and it was the great Muddy Waters sitting alone. And I walked over to him, and he and I vaguely knew each other. I had rediscovered Son House, who was his mentor in the Delta many years ago. So I sat down next to Muddy, and Muddy was shuffling a deck of cards, and he looked at me, and then instead of leaning forward, he sat back in the chair, and he put his arm on the back of the chair, and he straightened up as if to address the room, and he had that wonderful cadence. He said, I heard what you said to the boy. And I seen what you did. I said, boy had it coming to him. Boy didn't show no respect for the people. Boy didn't come ready to play. Then he leaned forward and he shuffled the cards again. He put his arm back again. He said, now some folks might say you got no cause to talk to the boy that way. But you told the boy what he needed to hear. Boy had it coming to him. He said, I had my eye on you, and you just keep on keeping on, and you'll do just fine. And I got up and I walked away, and I said to myself, I can do this. I can do this management thing, and I'm not going to be a sports writer anymore. This is what I'm going to do from now on.
And that was the point where you gave up sports writing. When you were managing blues musicians, your goal was to help them make a living, and of course to make a living for yourself, but you said that you didn't see it as, you know, about history. But now that the musicians who you rediscovered and who you represented have gone, now that they're dead, do you see the work that you did as having a historic value that you didn't quite see at the time?
It always surprises people when I tell them that I don't listen to their music at home. It's more than music to me that when I hear these men, I remember their aftershave lotion. I know what they drank. I know what kind of cigarettes they smoked. I remember that I would be with them when they'd finished the song, finished the set, and they'd stand up and walk towards me, and I'd take the guitar and we'd step into the darkness and they'd light a cigarette and we'd turn around and would wait to see if there was enough applause for an encore. And I'd put my hand on their shoulder, and I could feel their sweat. And when I hear their music, that all comes back to me. The cigarettes, the liquor, the sound of their laughter, just talking with them, riding in a car with them. There's just so much detail there that they weren't just calm, gentle, congenial, grandfatherly men that I was very honored. I was very privileged to have had them in my life, and they took me into their lives.
Is that why you don't listen to their records at home?
That is true. That is true. Because when I listen to them, they don't come to me as musical notes. They come back to me as people.
Dick Waterman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. I've enjoyed it.
Dick Waterman's blues photos are collected in the new book Between Midnight and Day. Here's a track from another musician who was managed by Waterman, Mississippi John Hurt.
I'll glance all right. Bad loving is blue. My baby packed a suitcase and she went away. I couldn't let her stay with my loving, with my loving spoonful. I just had to have that loving spoon. You can bring me whiskey, you can bring me tea. Nothing satisfies me but my loving spoon. Boy, that Maxwell house.